afternoon, and welcome to We the People. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Team Power. Team Power is our local John Deere Kubota dealer up in Shasta Lake, California. They're on 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake, just south of Phil's Propeller. Anything tractors, they can do it. If you're looking for a new tractor, want to trade in an old one, want to fix an old one, I know we're getting a lot of calls on machines that have been burned up in the fire, and we can help you with that process.
Need quotes for replacement and all that.
Yep, insurance quotes for replacement or repair. We can handle that. And also, just to let you know, we're working with Deere and Kubota to possibly throw some extra discounts for fire victims if you need to replace your tractor. So keep us in line on that. And you can reach them on the web at weddingtractors.com. And their phone number is 226-9226. That's Team Power.
Nice. I didn't even interrupt you.
No, you did good. I didn't even look at you.
I did look at you.
I didn't look at you.
Oh, yeah. See, that's the trick.
Makes me, yeah. Makes
Don't look over.
Yeah.
So distracting.
You are.
Oh, my goodness. So, let's see. I sound really loud all of a sudden. Why am I so loud there? I know people have been asking me that my whole life. Why are you all so loud?
Why do you sound like Ethel Merman?
It's a family problem. So you can't even use that anymore.
I know, because nobody knows who Ethel Merman is.
Yeah, I had a neighbor who used to say I had a voice like Ethel Merman. And she said it just like that, and she's making fun of me.
I think the Poseidon Adventure was the last time I saw Ethel Merman screaming on the way down. Yeah.
Or it's a mad, 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 mad world, which should be a cult classic by now. And I don't know why so many people have not seen it, although it was the best movie ever.
The Big W.
The Big W. All right. So today we're talking about the Big S.A., South Africa.
Yeah.
And we have some actually like late breaking news. Or not.
Late, very late breaking as of hours
this morning.
Ago. Yeah.
And I'm not going to mess that up. I'm going to let our guests tell you all about it. So let's see. This would be the, hold on, 1, 2, 3, 4. This would be the fifth show we have done on this topic. Some were an hour, some were two. And I've got those linked up on today's page. So if you just go to wethepeopleradio.us, you look at today, August 12th, you will, you'll have links to all of those. We've talked about the history of the Dutch. We kind of, I mean, believe it or not, I mean, we have a ton more to do on that one. We talked about the farm attacks that are going on in South Africa. So I don't know if you are aware of that. If you're not, that is, if you think that what's going on in the West is a problem, you should tune in on South Africa, because that's a whole different level of
violence.
Yeah, just horrible.
Mayhem.
And
yeah, and I'm hoping all these shows we're doing is bringing a little bit more national spotlight to it.
Well, it's interesting because I noticed that listenership has gone way up when we do these shows. So I think a lot of this information isn't being talked about in any type of, you know, at any type of length. I think you have articles out periodically, and I don't know what's happening on radio. I know our guest is doing lots of different radio. We also talked about the politics of white genocide, because that's actually what's going on. And then President Obama was down there, I'm going to say a month ago.
Yeah.
I don't know. And, you know, fanning the flames of white genocide. So if you think that this is all about, you know, kind of like a revamp or a redo of U.S. history, where some white people went to South Africa and enslaved black people and stole their land, blah, 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 and now they're just getting what's coming to them.
Yeah, and then Nelson Mandela came along and saved everybody.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, you really couldn't be more wrong on every single level. And so nothing like some good information to counteract either what you've been told, what you've heard, or what you've assumed. And I think in a lot of cases we do assume. You know, we overlay what we know and park somebody else in our history. So Dr. Harry Booyens is an internationally recognized multiple award-winning PhD defense and aerospace physicist. So he isn't just some guy who's talking about South Africa. I mean, he's an actual Cold War scientist who did all sorts of interesting things. We've had some really interesting phone calls. He is originally from South Africa with a 360-year bloodline in that country, He lives there. He currently lives in Canada with his family at the present time. He was in South Africa for, I believe it was 47 years. I don't know why that's not on here. But his life as a scientist exposed him to many of the realities of the Cold War and the period immediately following the fall of the Berlin Wall. It included interaction with the United States and British defense establishment. And so he's applied his lifetime of research and interpretive skills to history and genealogy, and he writes with factual accuracy and a really engaging style on these subjects. I mean, if you think he's fun to listen to, you should read some of his writing. We have listed on our website his book, Amabulu. I think I actually got it right before I second-guessed myself. The Birth and Death of the Second America. The parallels between the United States and South Africa are incredible. And I'm sure we can't go through all of that right here in a thumbnail, but we have done programming on that. I hope you'll listen. We have all of our archives are commercial-free. They are free to listen to. I know sometimes you have to subscribe and all that stuff. You don't have to log in or subscribe or do anything. You just click on them and listen. And they're free for you to download if you are somebody who can download an MP3 file and listen while you're, you know, working out or doing other things. Our archives are set up just for you. And each show has a page, so we have put all the pertinent information on there. And I will be adding an article from the New York Times on here and also some information that came through this morning. So that's all my part. Now we're out. Now it's all about Harry. And you have like 3 minutes before our first break, so you want to just kind of set the stage for us?
That I will do. And good morning, Aaron. Good morning, Bill. And good morning to your listeners. Yes, indeed. I'm what might be called an escaped Cold War warrior. And yes, I spent 47 years in South Africa. Your maths is correct.
I thought so.
And maybe the way I should use these 3 minutes is to say that today is quite significant. You've already hinted at it, in that the list of 195 farms that the South African government is trying to dispossess white people of without compensation, that list has escaped. It is in the hands of organizations that look after the interests of farmers. They've got those on the web. They've got it with little blocks to fill in to find out whether you are the target or not. That's where we are. In this high-tech world of today, the threatened farmer whose life now hangs in the balance has this morning to wake up and quickly fill his name into a block on the internet, find out whether the government is coming to just simply take his land and drive him off it. That's where we are now, finally, in South Africa. So wow. If you think the things that happened in northern Nevada and those places are terrible, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Yeah, this is like epic proportion.
Now, to understand all of that, I'm hoping today, if you'll allow me, to go back and sketch the picture behind all of this and to make the case for why the time has come for the United States to put pressure on that government in South Africa. That place has gone nuts, and it's time for the U.S. to make like it's the leader in the world.
All right. Make the case. Because I think it's like D-Day. Maybe we should. Sorry. That's why we have Ashley. She's like our she's our fun killer. They just call her the engineer, but she's really the fun killer. She just gave me the high sign. Okay, so let's take a quick break so we don't have to interrupt, and then we'll come back and start again with Dr. Harry Bouillons. And we're talking about South Africa today. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Radio. I'm ready.
Well, when I put that in the queue for last night, I didn't know we were only going to hear bad news, but I guess I had a sneaking suspicion. All right, so where should we go now?
Maybe we could...
see in the cone of silence?
Oh,
there you are.
Yeah, there we go.
I'm right here. I don't know when I'm allowed to speak.
Okay.
Oh, anytime. Just
could you give
you
us
know,
a quick
perfection
a
is our
quick,
goal.
Who's who of the leader of South Africa, the Cyril Ramaphosa? Is that how you pronounce it?
Let me put that in context for you. The president now is a guy called Cyril Ramaphosa.
Right.
He was Nelson Mandela's understudy. He was also the guy who negotiated the new South Africa with the previous government. As far as I'm concerned, he ran rings around them. And he was the man that Mandela actually wanted should follow him up. And it didn't work out back in 1999. And instead of Ramaphosa, it was a guy called Thabo Mbeki who got the president. Mbeki was removed hook, line, and sinker by Jacob Zuma, who turned out to be a classic African village chief, corrupt kind of creature. And he's been removed now by Ramaphosa. There was a cipher-type placeholder in between Mbeki and Zuma, but that doesn't really count. So the point that's important here is that we're dealing here with Mandela's preferred successor.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
he's
good.
A competent guy. He's a competent guy, make no mistake. Unlike his predecessors, he's not from one of the two biggest black nations in South Africa. People don't seem to realize there are at least nine different nations, each with his own language. So it's a little United Nations kind of thing there. And he is from the Venda people in the very far north of the country. And as irony tends to do so often in South Africa, his people arrived at the far northeastern end of South Africa almost simultaneously with when the Dutch arrived at the far southwestern tip. So go figure that a bit. Okay.
Okay.
So that's where we are now. That's who he is. That's where he fits. And what you need to know is that because his immediate predecessor, Zuma, who was a Zulu, because Zuma was removed from his seat before his term was up, there is still an election due, essentially, next year. And Ramaphosa would have to fight an election. And so, obviously, the question for these folks was, who can work up the basic backwater black crowd the loudest and the strongest, and what would be the means to do it? And the answer is, sick the dogs on the whites. Make everybody jump up and down and bay for blood. Promise you'll steal things from the white people, and the unthinking masses will vote for you. That's what's going on here. You need to get that straight.
Okay.
And so far, it's kind of been working out for them.
Well, on a continent where rational thought and deductive reasoning are not exactly at the top of the list, trying to argue around these things doesn't really help very much. Aaron, I sent you a link to what I can best describe as a weird, screaming black young lady. Don't know if you took a look at that link. That is what we're up against. It's essentially the African version of Antifa.
Yeah, they're just crazed, I guess.
Okay. So, welcome. You're sort of getting little bits of that in the U.S. In South Africa, it has a totally different connotation. There it's the majority, and they want you dead.
Yeah, the interesting part, it's funny because just as we were coming into the studio, the previous show was leaving and they were making a comment about Antifa and those guys got clobbered up in Portland. So, I mean, we're still able to push ours back, but The tables are totally flipped down there.
I shall never call for violence on the air. I shall never call for it in any meeting, but now and then somebody needs to be tapped lightly around the ears.
Mm-hmm. So this fella is basically an understudy of Mandela. Is this anti-white position? Was that Mandela's position as well, or is this something new?
Well, there is an unpopular line of thought in South Africa and in the world, and that unpopular line of thought goes something like, well, Mandela bamboozled the entire planet with the, aided and abetted by folks that were actually in the Obama administration, who carefully removed Mandela's communist involvement and his leadership of part of that party. They removed it from his books, and by the time the United States found out about Mandela, he walked on water. The rest of us who lived in reality knew the truth. And so now the problem is that for guys in South Africa who always knew that Mandela was a leader in the Communist Party, none of this, including Ramaphosa's insistence on essentially nationalizing white property, none of that comes as a surprise. For those who were deluded by what Richard Stengel did when he wrote Mandela's book for him secretly, well, not secretly, but he was the ghostwriter, those people are probably in some degree of shock now that they see what the real agenda behind Mandela actually was.
Sounds like it was a little bit of a repeat of the Castro story. I mean, we backed him, and then he turns out to be a communist.
I'm not that familiar with Castro's, except that I know what he did in Africa, because guys like me had to fight against him.
Hmm.
It's difficult. This is what makes it so tough to talk about South Africa. To be blunt, you folks in the U.S. have been BS'd to such a tremendous degree by the combination of your media and the ANC and its unmentioned headquarters in London that for me to get the slightest fact across, I have to correct 40, 50, 60 years of rubbish.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
This is the problem we have. It's also the reason why I wrote the book. And if I may, I would now like to go back to a little event in my own personal life, and I don't want to make this about me, but it will illustrate something. The final straw that made me pack up my family, give up a successful career, and move to Canada was when a person who was placed in the environment by the ANC as part of their so-called cadre deployment. They actually have words for this, right? As part of their cadre deployment, this guy was placed in our work environment. Now, what you need to understand is that is exactly the same thing as the KGB political officer that's placed on a Soviet submarine. The captain has no real say. He's got to go with what the agent says. So the problem is these guys were in our environment, placed there already by the year 2000 and before it. And this one, in front of black, Indian, and what in South Africa is called colored people, who I can subpoena as my witnesses, because they stood there pretty much trembling in fear, this guy looked me straight in my eyes and told me, "No, Harry, our plan is not just to get rid of the president of this company. Our plan is to get rid of everybody like you."
Wow. That's subtle.
Yeah.
And that is why I wrote in an original article.
Oh, that would be Bill's phone. It's probably the telemarketer calling again.
Somewhere back in 2006, I wrote an article when I said the reality was stenciled into my forehead. It's not like I have to speculate. It's not like I have to hear other people's opinion. Okay? This monster, I'm talking about the machine that is the ANC, much like Hillary has a machine. The ANC machine stenciled it into my forehead. I had to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to get the message. And the other people in that room, of all colors in that country, stood there too scared to open their yaps. Caught between their respect for me and their fear of the ANC. Or as the Indian chap told me afterwards, "Harry, I was clearly not white enough for the previous government. Now I'm not black enough for this one." I'm talking about the year 2000, 18 years ago, before many of these Antifa kids were even born.
Wow. And it's only gone downhill from there.
Yeah, so I knew it was coming. And at first I put together a new life for my family in Canada. And then my conscience got to me about, I cannot just sit here. I got to do something. And I got to stay within the law and within reason and within decency. What can I do? And the answer is, Harry, you're a scientist. You have a love of history. You love this genealogy thing. Why don't you use genealogy as the basis to work back through history to find out who was who in the zoo in your own tree, then place them at the events in the history of South Africa and write their story down along with all the hard, vicious, supporting evidence that no one can deny, including the British Hansard and the actual letters of governors and things like that. So the hard, hard evidence. Put that into a book and give that to the world under the title, When We're Dead, Maybe You'll Read This.
God. Yeah, maybe once they've achieved their goal.
And so I slowly, it took me 7 years to put this thing together. I eventually published it at the end of 2013. As an e-book, a lot of people got hold of me and said, no, we want a printed one. So I knew that was going to be a problem at 630 pages. But that's what happens if you have to speak the truth and provide the hard evidence. And I don't know of anybody else who's ever plotted his own family all the way through a history of a country in order to just simply prove these guys were real, they really lived, and honest to God, this is what happened to them. Will you hear us, please? You know? So I wrote all of that down, and it turned out to be this big thing that I say can serve as a doorstop or as what the police call a blunt object. You know, like I quit last time that I got on the stage about 6 weeks ago, held up my book in my right hand, held up Mandela's in my left, and I said, in the inimitable words of your president, mine's bigger.
and on that note, let's take a quick break. Oh, dire topic, gotta have some jokes. We are discussing South Africa with Dr. Harry Bullions. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. We the People Radio.us.
On Marrakesh Express. Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? They're taking me to Marrakesh. Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? You know, we're riding on the Marrakesh Express. They're taking me to Marrakesh. All on board the train. All on board the train. All on board.
Rockefeller, Campanella, Communist Bloc, Roy Khan, One for All, Toscanini, Dacron, Dingin, Boo Falls, Rock Around the Clock, Einstein, James Dean, Brooklyn, Down a Winning Team, Davy Crockett, Peter Pan, Elvis Presley, Disneyland, Bardo, Budapest, Alabama, Khrushchev, Princess Grace, Peyton Grace, Trouble in the Suez.
We didn't start the fire, it was always burning since the world returned.
Kind of a fitting song.
Yeah, but you left out the best line, Belgians in the Congo.
I know. I couldn't get the Belgians in the Congo. They were in a different verse.
Yeah.
I had to go for the communist rock part.
Yeah. Harry, I'm curious. When you left South Africa, you went to Canada. Why did you pick Canada?
Well, there's a tongue-in-the-cheek response, and then there's the practical one. The practical response is that I'm the kind of guy, I can't just live. I can't just exist. And to me, the idea of building a country is very important. It's part of my whole soul and being. And I felt like Canada was a place where I could still make a difference and where they would give me a chance to be a citizen. And it wouldn't take half my life to get to that point. And in addition to that, Canada still has something of a frontier feel to it, and that's something that's important to me as well. So I wasn't here long before I was in a car and up to the Yukon. You know, it's
mm-hmm. Oh, fun.
That's who I am.
Well, you know, we're busy burning down every tree that's been hugged for the last, you know, several decades. So if you ever, you know, have a burning desire to live on the moon, you could come to the West Coast and, you know, experience what that would be like.
Or you can go to the South where they're busy tearing down all the historic statues and rewriting history.
Yeah.
Maybe we could rewrite some new
you just carve
Dutch
out a
history.
Little... Yeah, carve out... Yeah, we could have new Dutch history. Why not?
Yeah.
Okay, so you wanted to tie up some loose ends for us.
Yes. I feel strongly that, you know, I had an experience on a video interview the other day where the thing was... I think fraught with assumptions, and the phrase that was used was modern South Africa is about Mandela. Well, you know what? What about the previous 4 decades of my life, which had nothing to do with them? Anyway, so let alone the other 300 and something years. And everything that led to today's South Africa and everything that's being thrown against people and everything that's used as an excuse comes from before Mandela. So if people are going to start with Mandela, then they're going to start with all these assumptions that you've been fed. You know, mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, the Western world drank the Kool-Aid. And so I had hoped at some point to try and give you the essential points of the South African historic background that pertain to the mess that we have now. Right. It's not as though I want to tell you the history of who lived where and which tree did he go and walk around. It's it has to do with the bits that count. So if you'll indulge me on that, that's where I'd like to go.
Sure.
And hopefully folks will then understand why this situation is so absolutely outrageous. Here's the thing. When the Portuguese sailed, I'm actually going to go back to the year 1488. Won't believe this. But when Odias sailed to find the route to the Indies, East Indies, as fate would have it, he got as far as my old birth town of birth, my old hometown, Port Elizabeth, at the end of South Africa. And for this, it's probably important to have just a mental idea of what the country looks like. The southern half of South Africa looks a little bit like an upside down triangle of which you've cut off the sharp bottom bit, so it's half a triangle. And Port Elizabeth is at the bottom of the eastern end of the bottom. So you have the south coast that's about 400-500 miles long. And Cape Town is at the western end. Port Elizabeth, that's the eastern end. Dyer's got as far as Port Elizabeth, very roughly. And near it, about 80 miles or so east of Port Elizabeth, is the Fish River, the Great Fish River. And that thing is incredibly important because that is where this is going to turn into war at that point. I'm telling you that now. The thing is, his men wanted to mutiny at that point because they thought they're going to sail off the end of the earth. So that was where he turned, and just a couple of miles west of that, he put a stone cross on the dune, and that stone cross was discovered much later. So that's where things turn. The significant thing here is that he, on the way to that point, stopped at this spot called Mossel Bay, which is halfway along that southern coast. And he managed somehow to end up in a fight with the Khoi people, who used to be called the Hottentots, and he managed to kill one of them with a crossbow. So that's how the Portuguese started in Africa. They managed to kill a guy with a crossbow. That's a great start. You know,
how to win friends and influence people.
So, yeah, exactly. And they'd been blown off course by a typical winter storm around the Cape, and they called it the Cape of Storms. When they got back home, the king told them, no. We have to do a lot more exploring, and I can't afford to call it the Cape of Storms, so we'll call it something positive, like the Cape of Good Hope. And that was King Henry the Navigator. So he changed it to the Cape of Good Hope. And then he sent Vasco da Gama, who did make it all the way to India. And on the way back, he also stopped at that Mossel Bay. And in his case, it got so bad, he fired a cannon at the Hottentot. So it just wasn't working great for the Portuguese. Like they just couldn't get on with the Hottentot. Now, these folks are spindly, relatively short people who mostly, the ones that they met, were hunter-gatherers or beachcombers. And so from the perspective of the Portuguese, these people were not prospective slaves. They're not built for the job. And they're being blown about by storms and things. And so the Portuguese decided this whole southern tip of Africa thing is for the birds. We want nothing to do with it. We are going to sail way out to the south and west and then round the tip of Africa without ever seeing land. And then we're going to land the first time round about where Mozambique is today. But the point is, on those two trips, they didn't see black people. I'll say that again slowly. On those two trips, nowhere in what is today South Africa did they see black people.
Interesting.
Okay. Now, fast forward 150 years. Is that fast enough? The Dutch settled the Cape. In that period, just before the Dutch got there, there were a couple of Portuguese shipwrecks because they tried to miss out that coast, and then big storms come up. Sometimes it's remnants of cyclones. And they got blown against that coast and obviously got shipwrecked there. And there's at least two accounts of people trying to walk all the way to Mozambique and most of them dying. And it's a gripping account of what happened and how they were turned to cannibalism and all kinds of things. And it's quite clear that the first time they meet black people is where Natal is today. That is the easternmost coastal province of South Africa, Zululand, basically, Zulu territory. And there was no such nation as the Zulu back then. The Zulu came much later. So I think the people were called the Mbo. MBO.
I mean, what's the terrain like there? Is it basic desert, high desert, or low, or ocean desert? Or?
Okay, so the lay of the land. I mentioned it's like an upside down triangle with a bottom half lobbed off.
Right.
Here, along the east coast, you have a hot or a warm sea current, making it subtropical and quite moist and quite wet, which tell you that the black people have the wet country that is arable. And then the west coast has a cold current, which, you know, is everything like you see on the coast of South America, where you have the Atacama Desert. Mm-hmm. We have the Namib Desert. So west coasts tend to be deserts, east coasts tend to be subtropical at that latitude. By the way, if you took South Africa and you moved it at the same distance from the equator, but in the northern hemisphere, then the southern bit of South Africa would stick into the south of the United States, and the bulk of it would be on Mexico. You got a feel for that?
Mm. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Likewise, distance from the equator, temperatures, structure, the lay of the land, climate, that stuff will follow mostly Mexico and then southern United States. So I grew up in what is essentially the equivalent of Arizona, southern Arizona. There are no pine trees in South Africa. In the time of the Portuguese, if I may use that phrase, up to before 1650, nobody ran into black people until they got deep into what is now the subtropical coast of Natal. Wonderful country, very wobbly. In some respects, it looks a little bit like the coast of Alabama, which I've driven through. The same sort of wobbliness with bush and trees in the dips between the hills. Now, then came the Dutch. And around 1680, I think 1678, maybe that vicinity, there was a ship that wrecked, a Dutch ship. And the guys from the shipwreck started walking to try and get to the Cape, but in the process they discovered people from two other shipwrecks, a British one and a French one. And when they got back to the Cape, they gave an account of their travels through that territory. And that confirmed that the nearest black people were far north in what is now Natal. This is probably time for you to take a break, so I'll stop there.
This Skype thing is working out great. I think that's something that people really need to understand, because country that wasn't taken from people shouldn't be taken back by those people. Except we have kind of a history in this country of, I don't know, it's confusing. Anyway, we'll be right back with our guest, Harry Bouillons. We're talking about South Africa. All the information about today's show, including the archive after the show, will be at wethepeopleradio.us. To inject a little USSR in there. Okay, back to the story. I won't derail you.
Okay. I've taken us sort of to near the end of the 1600s, I hope quick enough.
The interesting part about this, Harry, is up to this point, there still aren't any white people there. Or black people there.
Yeah,
that's the point. So, and here's the thing, and what makes the writing of the book for me such an incredible experience is that as I went along, I realized my own blood family were kind of at the forefront of some of these events. I didn't have somebody on that shipwreck but that I mentioned, but it was 1702, it was the year 1702, that white guys who had first landed at the Cape in 1652, a full 50 years before they met the first black people overland, and they did so somewhere between 500 and 600 miles west of Cape Town. Just to give you a feel for that, more or less where that Fish River is. That Fish River is always the place where the line gets drawn. Now, the history goes on, and there's all kinds of fun and intriguing things that happen that we can talk about, and I can tell you what a direct role the Cape played, for example, in your own War of Independence. If the French hadn't taken the Cape, you probably would have lost your War of Independence. But it was 1778 when the Dutch commander at the Cape, or governor he was called already by then, actually personally went out to that border and negotiated the frontier with those people. And it was decided that the Fish River would be the frontier. That's it. And for hundreds of years after that, the fights were always around the Fish River. Fish River was the boundary. So the next important point is that we get to the early 1790s. At that point, the Dutch East India Company, which had founded the Cape and on which everything had been built, was basically bankrupt. and its government at the Cape was equally useless. And the folks who lived on that border, these frontier guys, these were typically my ancestors. They're all over that place. And they rose up and physically ran the Dutch East India Company magistrate out of town. So they ran the sheriff out of town, if you wish. Well, he's actually a combination sheriff and judge. So this guy, almost the same time as what he gets to the Cape, on a Sunday in 1795, a message arrives via a purser from a British ship in False Bay outside Cape Town. And that message is, I am on the ship, I am a British commander sent by the King of England, and here is a letter that says you should deliver your colony to me. It's a nice letter to receive.
Yeah, welcome.
The Dutch command. Well, it's like the equivalent of what happened in 1664 in New York, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The British say the harbor and say, give it up. So they did the same thing over there. But apparently the letter was legit because the Dutch king had been driven out of Holland by the French, had fled to England, and the British had quickly pressed him to deliver such a letter so they could quickly grab all the Dutch places across the world and use them against the French. Having suffered the consequences of losing the Cape to the French during your War of Independence, they weren't going to tolerate this a second time. This time, they're nailing the door shut before Napoleon can take it. That was the argument. Now, as fate would have it, this happens at exactly the same moment that my folks rebelled on the eastern limit of the colony. And so through the eyes of the Brits, my ancestors were French Jacobins, in other words, people who chop your heads off. And so the Brits experienced them as their mortal enemy. And it's at that point that the first British governor commits to paper the following statement. So if you want to know where racial animosity and how it comes from and how it gets born, here's how it happens. This is a letter from the British governor to his boss in London in 1795, roughly. He says, I'm going to quote verbatim, "Amongst the measures which I have been anxious to carry into effect for some time past has been that of collecting and arming a body of Hottentots. Nothing I know would intimidate the Boers of the country more. I have assurance of near 200 arrived some days ago. I have promised to arm and clothe them, give them rations and sixpence a week, on condition of their engaging not to quit His Majesty's service for a year." Do you want it any more in your face and blunt than that? Okay, so imagine, in American terms, that the regular American guys are going about their normal thing on a very dangerous frontier, and the British governor, having won the War of Independence in this alternative universe where the Cape was not in your picture, this British governor sends a letter to London and says, you know, I am arming the Cherokee to oppress and basically suppress your guys. Smart move, huh?
Yeah, kind of lays out what they, I mean, honestly, the future of the country and the manipulation you guys are going
to
be.
Draw the lines.
And if you want to know, a little bit later, people ask me why the subtitle of my book is The Birth and Death of the Second America. Here is the reason. 1797, Admiral Pringle at the Cape. British Admiral Pringle, the boss of the later Nelson, the famous Nelson, this is his boss, and he writes, "As the colony improved and its peoples increased, it would to us only prove a second America, and would more likely in time rob us of India." How do you like that? So
yep.
That's the reason why you've got to sit on the necks of these guys, make sure it doesn't turn into another America. So whether you guys want to know it or not, we're your little cousin, and this is what got done to us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
The difference being the British one.
Yeah, you have no idea what... Maybe this gives you some feeling for what would have happened if you had lost your War of Independence. Okay, so the history goes on, and you can see that people are smarting. The governor sends his men to go and put down the so-called rebellion. It wasn't a rebellion against the British. They were glad that the Brits had really arrived. They didn't want these hapless Dutch any further. These guys couldn't manage the border. The Brits at least are prepared to shoot. And look what the new guys do. They misunderstand completely who's who in the zoo. They send the British army to disarm the frontier men. Can you imagine a British army being sent to disarm Davy Crockett?
Yeah, that's not going to go over very well.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and that's what happened. And they told the guys, if you give up your arms, we'll be completely lenient. All will be forgotten. And when the guys did that, they put them on a ship, appropriately called the Rattlesnake. And the Rattlesnake took them to Cape Town and put them in the castle jail. And that's where my ancestral brother then went. And he had to live in that jail for 2 years for kicking out the magistrate out of town and for the Brits not understanding who's who in the zoo. End result, what happens when you disarm your frontier? What kind of how big a genius do you have to be to understand if you disarm, if you take away the defenses of your frontier, someone's going to invade? And that's exactly what happened. Those black folks on the frontier, they were over the frontier in a flash with the help of some of the Hottentot near the eastern boundary. And there was a massacre of my own ancestors. And, a lot of interesting stuff happened that the present ANC government would not want people to know about. For example, they would not want people to know that in the first two wars between white and black, the ANC's main human base, the main human material, actually fought on the side of these ancestors of mine against others. They would not want to know that Makrota King defended my wife's ancestors, gave them safe harbor, sent captains to protect them.
Wow, yeah, that kind of messes up the narration a little bit. We're going to take a hard break right here.
But it does make sense. Yeah, it definitely makes sense of what's going on.
Right.
All right. We're going to come back with more from our guest, Dr. Harry Booyans. We're talking about South Africa again today. And I hope you're learning something. If you need backstory, we've obviously talked about other things on this topic. You can go to our website, wethepeopleradio.us, and it is all there for you. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. Today we're talking about South Africa with our guest, Dr. Harry Booyans. And kind of getting a lay of the land, because this is all really, it should be front page news, but it's not.
Nope, nobody's talking about it.
And Bill needs to do the sponsor, but I was just going to do it in a different order today.
Well, you do it however you... In fact, you do the sponsor. I'll let you do the sponsor.
You don't want me to do the sponsor.
You're right, I don't want you to do it. Today's sponsor...
Darn it, I was going to do it too.
Our sponsor this hour is Team Power, our local John Deere Kubota tractor dealer. They reside up in Shasta Lake, California, and they avoided getting burned down.
I was just going to say,
fire.
It didn't even get burned down.
No, they just got the smoke and the ash. But they're on Twin View Boulevard, 3119, just south of Phil's Propeller. And they have a lot of inventory, a lot of tractors in stock. Go up and see them. They make you a deal. They're working with the fire victims to get their tractors repaired and replaced. And you can also reach them on the web at readingtractors.com. Their phone number is 530-226-9226, so give them a call.
And many thanks to all of our other sponsors, Karen, Ken, and...
Oh, yeah, yeah. very instrumental in keeping us on the air.
Yes, and we really appreciate all you guys that are jumping in and helping with the show. And sponsorship doesn't have to be a big deal. Doesn't have to be a company thing, however you like to pitch in. And we really appreciate you. Lynn, just thinking of other people. Random.
Yeah,
random thoughts.
We've got some great folks out there that help support our show every month, and we do appreciate it.
It's really nice. You can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us. All right, back to South Africa.
Okay. So, here we go.
Here we go.
I have fiddled my sound here a little bit. I trust it works better for folks.
It sounds really good.
I've left it to the technology to adjust the volume. Now, the picture that I've just presented you is around 1800. History gallops forward over lots of great drama that I could spend hours on but wouldn't help your listeners to understand things very much, except to say that around 1815, the British managed to create a situation where another couple of farmers, this time involving my wife's ancestors, they rose up and rebelled, and then the Brits wanted to hang them. When they did so, they got the same army to build the scaffold, and when they tried to hang the guys, the ropes broke, and you can imagine what happened to that scene, and then they simply hanged them again to make sure the job worked.
Oh, boy.
That
wow.
Taste in the mouth. So with that, it was out between Boer and Brit. That you do not do, because the breaking of the ropes was seen as the hand of God, and it was over. There was no further discussing. All it now needed was, a little spark somewhere in the bush. So by now we are at roughly the sixth frontier war is about to begin. The first two were between the Dutch and the black people, and the rest were between the Brits and the black people. Now, in 1820, British settlers settled in South Africa, and if you think that the British government was nasty to my own original Dutch ancestors, here's what they did to their own people. They landed them right on the frontier, on the Fish River, just to the west of the Fish River, facing this very dangerous frontier, and used them as cannon fodder against the black people if they were to attack. Which they did at the end of 1834, and they murdered as far as they went. And most of the English settlers fled to the towns. At the end of this war, the British government blamed the British settlers and my own ancestral Afrikaans guys for what had happened.
Now, was this the Zulu Wars?
No, we're not at the Zulus yet. The Zulus come later.
Okay.
Give me 3 years to get to the Zulu.
Okay, jumping ahead there.
3 years and 3 minutes.
Countdown 3 years to Zulu.
So at the end of this exercise, things had turned liberal in Britain. The black people actually had missionaries who went and represented London, and my folks had no one to speak for them. At the end of this, my folks decided that's it. They've had enough. They cannot handle this ham-fisted management by the Brits any further. So they packed their ox wagons. Your guys did it with horse-drawn wagons. Ours did it with ox-drawn wagons. They loaded up their family Bibles, their families, what furniture they had on these heavy ox wagons, and they trundled north into the unknown, which they thought to be better than living any further with the Brits. The situation was so pathetic that it was the British settlers who stood together to buy, for example, a Russian leather-bound Bible for the one trek leader. So the British settlers and my guys were getting along just fine. And they were now in the same mess together because the British government had turned out to be the enemy of the people.
Mm, okay.
So understand that the ordinary Afrikaner like me does not have any case with the British as a people. We have it with these horrendous governments they've had who have done these horrendous things in their name elsewhere. Elsewhere being where I grew up. Now, The and that's also why I seem to have a preponderance of British friends here.
We're losing your sound again, Harry.
Oh, no.
Sound. I'm sitting dead still.
We have him on one leg with an arm in the air, and he's holding a banana in the other hand and a pencil in his teeth.
Neither am I don't know what to do about this one. That's just the quality of... Okay, can you still hear me?
Yep, there you are, you're back.
My best, yeah. I'm sitting dead still, I promise you. I am still... Now, the guys went up to the north. The first thing they found is that as you get to the central part of the country, you enter what is best described as classic North American prairie. Cold in winter.
We lost him.
It's grass. Now, I have one question that I think I've posed before. That is, I'm sure all of you have seen National Geographic for many years. How many pictures of you have of black tribes stand in the snow?
Uh-oh. That'll cut out so bad.
Harry, we're losing you.
We can't make that out. Let's take a really quick break and see if we can reconnect. I'm going to recall you on Skype and see if we can make that come out better. I thought maybe I was doing something, typing.
I think it's just a connection.
We've got something funky going on here.
The good part, too.
I know. We're almost to the Zulus. Countdown to Zulu is going to take a little longer than we thought.
Let's take a quick break and do it.
We'll take our break a little bit early and then reconnect.
Can you hear my voice this time? This is my fight song. Take back my life song. Prove I'm all right song. My power's turned up. Starting right now, I'll be strong. I'll play my fight song. And I don't really care if nobody else believes. Cause I've still got a lot of fight left in me.
There was a battle there,
in Zaire, in Zaire.
100,000 people there,
in Zaire, in Zaire.
All those people gathered there,
in Zaire, in Zaire.
See the rumble in the jungle there,
in Zaire.
Came a man called Eli John.
Okay, that's some trivia.
Yeah? I could not tell you who that was.
1976? Sporting event? Boxing?
Boxing. Oh, Ali versus Foreman.
Check.
Yeah.
That was the song about that.
I'll be darned.
I know. Ooh. I was digging deep. I found another one. I've got another sporting event coming up. There's some there were some pretty good sporting events in South Africa, and they made some songs about them. So, anyway, I thought I would grab those for today. All right, Harry, our signal's good now. We're good.
Okay, excellent. Apparently, Skype has come through for us. Okay, so we are now in around 1836. My ancestors, who were largely Dutch, German, French derived. Have now been joined by British settlers who find themselves in the same miserable situation as my ancestors. They now understood very quickly and very easily why there was trouble with the British government. Everybody's more or less on the same side. But there's one profound difference. The British guys who had arrived were subject to British law because they'd been born in Britain. And my guys, if they were to leave the territory, were not subject to English jurisdiction or British jurisdiction. So our guys packed their wagons, their Bibles, mostly their Bibles, and they went north into what was essentially or still is the South African prairie. It is higher, like 4,000 foot and higher. It is cold in winter. It can get bitterly cold there. In fact, I have both British and Canadian soldiers on record saying they never got as cold in their lives as they did during the Boer War in that part of the world. So they went into that part of the country, and the bit I believe that you lost due to signal quality is when I sarcastically commented, and I apologize for the sarcasm, but
it comes
with being born in a place where you are under threat all the time. You have to be able to joke in the graveyard. So the point there is you've all seen National Geographic. I suggest you mail me the pictures that you have of half-naked black African tribesmen standing in the snow and frost. Please, I'd like to have those.
Yeah, that'd be a big zero.
I missed that one.
Alternatively, pay the $1,500, fly out there in winter, and how about you go and stand there half-naked for half a day at Bloemfontein in the heart of the Free State with Skype, and let me know what it feels like.
Yeah, we'll be sure and call you.
Sorry, you'd be excluded from the attire arrangement, Aaron.
I'm
talking
it.
To Bull. Bull can stand and freeze there and lose body parts. Now, so the comment is, obviously, that central part was not occupied by black people. It was open country. In fact, I have the written accounts of people who went on that trek, and they describe how they are finding entire fields of white bleached human skeletons. Because, you see, there was another factor at work, and that is that along the East Coast, a new nation had arisen from all kinds of pieces of others, and its name was the Zulu. It was led by a despotic guy called Chaka, who had recently been killed by his half-brother Dengane, and Dengane was now the chief, and he was overseeing a very martially oriented nation where a young man could not have a wife until he had either killed a lion or killed an enemy, and all kinds of rules like that. When Chaka's mother died, for example, he walked up and down the ranks of his soldiers, and if they didn't cry real tears, he had them killed. You're talking about an extreme situation, a really extreme. But those guys were probably the bravest soldiers the world had ever seen. They put together the most amazing nation, a nation that can call up an entire army in like a day. They're impressive to see how they function. Okay? So this was a war machine that no one on earth had ever come up against in a regular written history. But Prairie was a renegade Zulu guy. I'll call him Zulu. He was actually in Ndwandwe, I think. But a renegade Zulu captain who put his own nation together and trained them more or less the same way. And these two used the central prairie to fight each other. Hence, the bleached skeletons.
Wow.
So our guys went into this bleached skeleton country, and they were detected by Mtsilikazi, the king to the west, who attacked them because he perceived them as blindsiding him. If they had just checked with him, he might have let them through, but they didn't know what his rules were. And so there was a big battle. With something like 5,000 of Mtsilikazi's guys versus 35 men in a wagon circle. And Mtsilikazi was defeated at that battle, but he went off with all these people's cattle. And so there had to be a temporary retreat. Eventually, however, these guys gathered all their means. More people left, including my family ancestors, joined all of those, and they made their way around the north of what is now the independent mountain country of Lesotho, which is where the Sotho people live, or lived. And they made their way for the east coast of South Africa, around the top of the really high mountains. And that is where they then camped, and 100 men went off with the leader, Piet Retief, another French descendant, to negotiate land with a Zulu king. I have the signed contract. I have a copy of the signed contract. Can I make that any clearer? Admittedly, the king and his assistants made crosses because they couldn't write, but they did so in the presence of the British missionary who drew up this contract between the Zulu-speaking Zulus and the Dutch-speaking Afrikaners, and it was drawn up in English.
Interesting.
So I have that, and it says clearly that the land between the Tugela River, which is north of Durban in South Africa, the coastal city, and the Umzimvubu in the south, which is a big river far south, that they would exchange that land for these trekkers of ours, which is where you guys get the word trek from. They would exchange that land for these trekkers, helping them to regain the cattle that another black chief in those big mountains that they had passed, if they would help them get that back, the cattle back, which they did.
Now, so how much land are we talking about?
Ooh, it's probably a stretch width of 100 and something miles, I think.
Okay.
North to south and inland, a bit more than that.
Okay.
Okay. Essentially, much of the southern half of the Natal province.
Okay.
Much of the southern half of it. And ultimately, what happened is they did that, returned the cattle in the hands of Zulu chiefs who took it back to the king. And then they went with a celebratory group of 100 guys to go and finalize everything, sign the contract, the whole thing, and or endorse the contract, whatever the right words would be, upon which the king promptly had them impaled.
Ooh.
Oh, whoops.
Whoops. So much for the contract.
So much for the contract. So 100 guys were killed and impaled, and it wasn't good enough to just do that. They had to kill Pitratif's son in front of his eyes and impale him in front of his eyes before they cut out his own liver and buried in the path on the way to the rest of the trekkers. Then the king sent his army to attack the women and children in the remaining camps where they had their wagon circles. Well, some of them were not in wagon circles, which led to the killing of 400 of them. But elsewhere, these guys were defeated, which is where, as I explained to the guy at our local Safeways. At the local Safeways yesterday, he's organized some English mints for me there, and I explained to him the significance of English mints, because the discarded tins of the English mints, which is the only candy that these trekkers of ours had, they used those to put individual bullets into those and then throw them into a cannon all into the mouth of their little homemade bronze cannon. They had a little homemade bronze cannon, and that way they could get shrapnel, because they realized that the cannonballs weren't doing much to the Zulus, so they created shrapnel on the spot.
Out of mint?
So out of mint tins.
Tins.
Oh, mint tins. I'm like, what? They dumped the mints in there?
You're talking about muskets.
Sorry.
These guys poured their own lead, right?
They made big their mints own for that part.
Yeah.
So this is where English mints come into winning a war.
Interesting.
Interesting stuff like that from real history. Okay, you can't come up with that in a story of fiction. So that kind of eventually led to the trekkers retaliating, and they defeated Dingaan with the help of his other half brother. Can that sink in, please? One Zulu half brother king of the king helped the white trekkers, my ancestors, to fight against his own half-brother to drive him from Natal. And he fled, and he was killed by the Amaswazi, by Subuza of the Amaswazi.
So at that point, the contract was made whole again?
At that point, the contract was made whole again, yeah.
Okay.
So, but here's the problem. On the very day that our guys defeated the Zulu, and this is always true and ironic like this in South Africa. It's like irony rules the play. The very day they had that big victory in which something like 3,000 Zulu soldiers die and not a single guy on the trekker's side. There were three flesh wounds. That's it. Mm. On that very day, the British land at what is now Durban hoist their flag. And what was that bit you said about a flag earlier?
Mm-hmm. Yep. If you got a flag.
They hoist their flag and said, "We're back."
Wow.
Where's Archie? Right. So, and that's what always happens, you know. And as soon as you have the Brits there, then it takes a couple of weeks before they start sending bogus letters back and forth saying, "Oh, these Boers are busy with slavery and I don't know what else." And in the end, the British governor at the Cape wrote in a letter that really his intent is to drive these guys away from the coast and move them to the wastes of the interior where they will be less of a burden to everybody. That's now what he wants to do to my ancestors. So most of them left and went to the wastes of the interior where they would be less of a burden to everybody.
What do you mean?
There, they were baptized by an American from the Rocky River County. In, what is it? I think it's Ohio, unless I'm mistaken. And he then were settled in the Rocky River County of the Natal province. So he went from Rocky River to Klipriver, which is just Afrikaans for Rocky River.
Hmm.
And he baptized my wife's ancestors and so forth. Actually, my wife's great-grandmother was baptized by him. So, and he created the Dutch Reformed Church in those interior provinces. So that was done by an American. And now you know how the Orange Free State arose in the middle on the prairie. Other than one fight with Umtsilikazi, who didn't live there, you haven't heard of major clashes with black people. It's because they weren't there.
Right.
Back to National Geographic.
Back to National Geographic. How many freezing, half-clad tribesmen have you ever seen standing in the snow?
That's pretty. That is pretty crazy. We need to take a really quick break here at this point, because I don't want to cut you off in the middle of the next phase. This is a great. I mean, this is all the stuff that we never learned. Actually, wonderful. Okay, so South Africa with Dr. Harry Booyens. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Yourself up and dust yourself off and back in the saddle. You're on the front fire, everyone's watching. You know it's serious, we're getting closer, this isn't over. The pressure's off, you feel it, but you got it all, believe it. When you fold it up, oh, oh, and if you fold it up, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sangalewa, cause this is Africa. Tamina, mina, eh, eh. Time for Africa.
I just wish people could see the dancing that's going on over in Bill's chair. It's right up there with my mints. Okay, so that song.
I know some African dances.
That song. That was the song from the 2010, World Cup.
Well,
there you go.
There you go.
Well, two
sports. How much I know about baseball.
Nice. Two sports trivia songs for you that had to do with Africa.
Yeah.
Had to dig deep on that one.
Yeah, you did.
All right. Our foolishness is over, Harry. We're back. Actually, I'm not sure it's over. We subdued it, though. Doing our best.
Well, I went and I was nice. I took the bag of peppermints from the guy at Safeways, and I have it in my hands here. You know, I can
killer peppermints.
Should be crackling like really. You can hear it. Okay, that's my celebratory rustling of peppermints in view of what happened in 1838.
Yeah, put down the mints. You're making me nervous.
Now,
yeah, put your hands up and drop the mints.
That really happened. So the Brits just moved in and took that country. There was some fighting, and our guys retreated back to the interior to go and live, as I say, in the wastes of the interior where there would be less of a burden on, quote, us British, unquote. Now, that all went fine for a while. And then, one day, a guy turned up with a weird shiny little stone in the western end of this waste of the interior.
Uh-oh.
And he took it to another guy who knew a little bit more about Chinese stones. And that one took it and scratched a pane of glass with it in the town of Colesberg, where my family was. And that mark is still on the window there. And he announced that this is a diamond, which they then had tested in various other places, including by the French consulate. I have no idea why that is. But yes, it was a diamond, which of course leads to the following immediately very rational response. The British government announces that they believe that these Boers in the waste of the interior are trying to apply slavery to some people to the west that no one seemed to know about. And therefore, the British have to rush to the rescue of these people, which they then supposedly did, and followed that immediately by moving all of those people out of the territory where the diamonds are into the face of the Amakosa people on the far southeastern coast where they don't belong, and they had the diamonds. And that's it. So whenever a second party says they're worried about what you're doing to a third party, you should smell a rat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay? And that pattern has persisted for as long as the British spent time in Africa. They would pick a fight in that particular fashion. It would always be about some or other human right of a third party, which they would ride to the rescue of this third party and then promptly move them out and take it over. That's the pattern. And that then set the western frontier of the Prairie State, with the farmers, of course, now accidentally having found themselves on top of what was supposed to be the waste of the interior and turned out to be the diamond mines of Kimberley. Hmm. Now you know where Kimberley is. It's in the part of the country that should have been part of the Orange Free State between two rivers, but there's a little piece lobbed out because the Brits did that. They wanted the diamonds. And so they added that to the Cape Colony. And the Boer were now pressed from the east, because they weren't supposed to be at the coast, and they pressed from the west, because they're not supposed to be close to the diamonds. Anyway, they carried on living their prairie life with their, I could flash back, I'd say if John Deere's were around in those days, they'd have been driving those, but they didn't have those, so they were plowing with their regular plows, and they were growing their corn and ranching their cattle, and closer to the mountains where there's a little bit of rain, they planted wheat. And so that became the breadbasket of the country. And it has been that ever since the 1850s. And it's over that period that many of my Boyan's family moved into that area. And they're in communication with me every now and then, like yesterday. And so the bit I didn't tell you so far is that when that fight happened with the Zulu, a part of these trekkers went further north, crossed the Vaal River, or the Vaal River, went to the far end of this high prairie and down the northern side of it where it turns tropical. And that is where they ran into a number of different nations, including that of the guy called Malema, who's screaming, kill the whites, kill the farmer, from the stage.
Mm.
Okay? But even then they didn't run into the new president's people. That happened even a bit later. So the picture that you need to have is that of a huge colony called the Cape Colony, starting from the southwest of South Africa. You need to view another colony on the coast along the east coast called Natal. And then here in the middle sits the prairie province called the Free State. My contention is the following: that what used to be the old Cape Colony all the way up to the Fish River is essentially white territory, and that much of the Orange Free State Prairie country is white territory. To the east of that live some of the refugee black people called Sotho, living in those mountains, and to the west live the Tswana people. To the north live all the others. Along the coast live various black people north of the Fisher River. Now, if anybody listening, and including yourself, Aaron and Bill, if you have Google anywhere around, you may want to go to the Wikipedia page. And when you're in Wikipedia, just put in the languages of South Africa. It's interesting and a very revealing thing to do. Languages of South Africa. And I'll wait for a couple of seconds to tell me you can see it. So we're looking on
it's a race.
We're looking.
I got it. There's 11.
Okay, so if you're on Languages of South Africa on Wikipedia, you roll that thing down until you get to the bottom.
Yeah.
And coming from the bottom, you'll see a first picture that shows the map of South Africa with a lot of green on it.
Yep.
That is the distribution of West Germanic languages. Whoever did that is very clever. That was his way of saying white people. and Indians and so-called colored people, who are the descendants of all the old Dutch East India Company slaves, the Khoi or Hottentot people, etc., the whites, all mixed up. That's the real nasty legacy of apartheid, is what was done to those folks. Okay? And just for the record, I am a descendant of a Khoi girl, so-called Hottentot. So I figure I have the right to call her Hottentot. And so all those people to me are Afrikaners. They just speak different languages. They are all people who were either indigenous to the original Cape or they came there from other places and swore loyalty to Africa. You see that green distribution?
Yeah, I mean, it's 80 to 100%. So it's not just, you know, the proportion of the population that speaks a West Germanic language as its first language, the bulk of that area is 80 to 100%.
Yeah, and that, as you expect, it gets thinner to the edges, very much like the Russians and the Ukrainians argue about who's who in the zoo near the border. Okay? You look at that, and where the sort of medium-colored green peters out along the coast, that is where the Fish River is.
Okay.
And you can see the agglomeration of green further north. That is the capital of Pretoria and Johannesburg. Okay.
Yeah, so obviously either the people from Africa learned English and somehow passed it off as their first language, or they didn't live there.
I assure you.
Back to National Geographic.
I could probably count the people on the fingers of one hand who are black and speak Germanic languages, first language. Right, the topmost map does something else. It by virtue of language shows you the distribution of the black nations of South Africa.
Yeah, and that's all along the eastern side.
Yeah. You see the green patch in the middle?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Though that's the prairie state, mostly covered by Sotho people. You see the gray country stuck in the middle of South Africa?
Yeah, what is that?
That is the Mountain Kingdom independent state. Part of the British Commonwealth has always been a separate country, the true home of the Sotho people.
And so, say again, you cut out right there. The gray part is what is who?
What I'm saying is that gray little thing is the Mountain Kingdom of the Sotho.
Of the Sotho.
It has always been an independent country since the 1800s. And that's the true home of the Sotho people, the Basotho. But somehow they've run all over the Orange Free State, which is the central prairie state. So what you should do is that light green color should be painted into Lesotho as well, and they need to be asked, what the devil are you doing in the Prairie State if your own country is Lesotho?
Yes.
Did people know that some of these folks who are laying claim to South Africa and want to chase the whites away have their own independent country anyway? I bet you that nobody that's listening knows that, except maybe the few South Africans. Okay. Do you see the pink people to the northwest of the Prairie State? Okay, starting to encroach on the Prairie State. Do you see the huge, big gray lump north of them?
Yes. Right.
That is their own country. That is Botswana, where the Tswana people have their own country. But they're all over South Africa, demanding that the whites be kicked out.
And so this keeps changing over time.
Yeah. And so what's happened is that those two nations, the Sotho and the Tswana, have basically encroached on the Orange Free State and outnumbered the whites.
Which is handy if you want to steal all their land. It's a numbers game. We have to take a really quick break here, or we'll be at the top of the hour here. We're going to be right back with our guest, Dr. Harry Bouyans. And we're talking about South Africa. And I hope that if you weren't able to pull up a map during this whole thing, you'll go back, listen to this part, and pull up a map. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
There's always going to be another mountain. I'm always going to want to make it move. Always going to be an uphill battle.
Just about where the people are in South Africa. Tell you what, they're probably looking at somewhere over the rainbow at this point. So, Harry, we're in our last like 10 minutes here.
I'll pull it together.
For the people that are on that list of 195, what are their choices?
Well, so just to explain that number, on this very morning, the government plan escaped into the hands of some organizations who've published the lists of which farms are going to be targeted. Now, one would expect that those farms are in the northeast of the country, if you look at that map.
Mm-hmm.
But they've spread them all around, and my job for the rest of this day is to go and check where those farms are. We don't know what this lot is going to do. They clearly don't care about the Constitution, because they said if the Constitution is in their way, they're going to change it. And but the threat is that these folks are going to have their farms simply taken away. That is what the government said in so many words. Now, they may backtrack. They may try and put that in softer terms. They may try to execute it in softer terms. We just don't know. But you can imagine that right now, as we're speaking, the value of that land is dropping through the floor.
Well, sure. When the government comes up and says, basically, we're going to nationalize everything, and it now belongs to us, you really don't have much to say about it.
So any farmer who's looking at this list at this morning knows that basically his life as a farmer is over because the value of his land is falling. What's he going to do to raise a loan for next year's crop? You know, you can't... I'm sorry, but...
Bless you.
You can't actually talk to governments and leaders who do things like this. They don't understand how things work. And it's important to look at that top map on that page because right in the far northernmost little chip of that map, you see a light green color. That is where the president of the country comes from. And his people arrived there when the Dutch arrived in the Cape in 1652. Below him, you see an orange patch. That is the territory of the guy that is yelling, kill the farmers, from a stage all the time. So these people are yelling about it. They're all from that far northern corner of the country. And they're trying to make rules to basically wipe white people out all over the country. And they're going to get away with this because the Western media is not calling them on it. The U.S. government is not calling them on that, and I personally believe the time has come for targeted sanctions against the individuals who are perpetuating this kind of nonsense in that country. It has been done to the Russians. It's been done to the Iranian government. It is time that this is done to the individuals in the South African government who go around endangering the lives of people and go around destroying the principle of private property, which underpins the Western world.
Because these folks are completely, I mean, they're outmaneuvered. Who represents them at all, at any level?
An organization called AfriForum is the best that they have. And then they have an organization called the Suidlanders. It just means Southlanders. And that second one is more like a civil defense organization organizing points where they can gather and be safe and stuff like that. But that to me is like a plan D or C or whatever. As far as I'm concerned, there is no plan A. And the only option that I see is either the U.S. government starts nailing the South African government for being completely out of line with every norm on this planet, or the white people of South Africa have to leave the northeastern region, pull back and consolidate inside the green area that you see on that map, and hive themselves off in a formal secession as allowed by the Constitution to create two countries. The one on the west, we can call the Cape of Good Hope. I don't know if you ever saw the movie, I don't know what it was called, Millennium or something, but it's where the earth goes to pieces and finally they're all rescued in big barges and they set sail for the only possible place that remains, which is then suitably the Cape of Good Hope. So to the west is the Cape of Good Hope, and to the east, as far as I'm concerned, will be the People's Democratic Republic of Azania.
Hmm. Harry, what is the population? What's the numbers of whites that are threatened by this new programming? What are we talking about?
Something like half the white population lives in the green territory and the other half lives inside the northeastern part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
That's in terms of the spread. The white population is something like 9 to 10% of the total population. The so-called colored people are roughly the same, slightly fewer. And then there's something like probably between 1 and 1.5 million Indians, almost all in Natal, who by now must be shaking in their boots because in 1948 the Zulus chased them over a cliff so they fell to their deaths.
And so what is the population? You say 10%?
Of the whole country?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're talking 10% of the whites that are going to be affected by...
No, I didn't say 10% of the whites are going to be affected.
They are 10%
I said the whites in total are 10% of the country's population.
Right. And what is that number?
It's about 4.5 million.
Okay. All right.
So you're basically talking about a nation the size of the Irish being threatened with extinction.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so we're not just talking, you know.
I mean, this isn't a few hundred people.
Handful of
this isn't back
farms.
To the peppermint war.
Yeah, no, we're talking millions.
This is not Rhodesia, guys. This is saying you're talking about the destruction of something of the scope of Norway or Belgium or the Irish.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Yeah, just put that in perspective.
And I'm telling you that the only option, if it keeps going like this, and the U.S. does not take action, the only other option is splitting that country in two, like North and South Sudan. In that case, the blacks to the south and the more Arabic people to the north. In this case, it will mean dividing it more or less along where the green is. And the end result will be, I promise you, that the bit to the east will become the People's Republic of Azania, or the People's Democratic Republic of Azania, which... at the moment, they are together only because of their joint hatred of white people and their exploitation of that. And if those whites move out of there, those guys are going to turn on one another, and you are going to see something you have never seen before in your lives. When those Zulus arm and get going, the rest are going to run until their mothers can't help them.
Right.
God.
That's not going to be a pretty sight.
Ugly. All right. We are going to have to take off for today, but... I guarantee you are going to talk about this some more. And thank you for all the perspective, actually. So now we can, people can get engaged. And I hope they do go get more information. Dr. Harry Booyans, you are always a wealth of information.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, anytime. And you've been listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. And we'll be back next week.